the one thing that almost always predicts failure is trying to play what Dan Kennedy would call blind archery.
Blind archery.
Blind archery. Why would you want to go out and try to shoot a target blindfolded when there's all this information sitting out there for you and you can put on a set of ultra-modern military laser-focused guided target binoculars and see exactly what you're going for?
I think the reason would be is that I'd want to show how strong I was.
Yeah, there's something about human nature that says, I don't need research, I know the market, I know what they want, I want to go on my gut feelings. And the few times that we've all had a success like that, it almost feels like you're magic, right? You almost feel like a miracle person.
Right.
And we're all really seeking that magical feeling, but if you want to play the odds, I think it's just deadly. I know it's been for me. I spent years developing a software program to help people with their dreams, only to figure out that
nobody wanted it.
Well, there's a lot of demand for people interested in analyzing their dreams. They don't want to pay for it. They feel like it's something they should have for free, or if they're going to pay for it, then you have to rise to the level of claiming you're psychic, and you've got an interpretation that nobody else has.
If they want a program, we found out that they wanted something magical,
right.
Rather than, this is really about me.
Right. But the point is, there's a lot of years in my life, and it was a big dream that I had, that I could have avoided, what did I spend, $50,000 trying to market that, and years perfecting the software, and redesigning the website, and I could have avoided all that.
By
doing my research.
So let's talk about the importance of doing research and what gets in the way of that.
I think what gets in the way is what I just described, which is, I'm going to use the word narcissism, but I don't mean it in the people typically think of derogatorily. What I mean is more like a self-centeredness, where we get excited about an idea, and we think that we must be the market. And early in our life as psychologists, I think we were both enamored with the idea that the most personal is the most universal. And I think when you're sitting one-on-one with someone, sometimes that can be true. Sometimes when you have a thought and you're deeply in touch with your feelings and the imagery that goes along with that, you might be picking up what's actually going on for the other person. And I think that's a valid process on a one-to-one level.
I think the most personal is the most universal makes sense when it comes to emotion, but it doesn't make sense with shoe size. The most personal for me is a size 8 1/4 on my left foot and 8 1/2 on my right foot.
Right.
For you, it's a 12,
exactly.
And we both have feet and we both wear shoes and we both have a personal need to cover our feet. What the specifics of what we need in terms of the type of shoe and the function of the shoe, that's the case where the most personal is not the most universal.
Right, exactly. I'm fond of saying that the only marketing problem is narcissism, which you can kind of think of as wishing that your marketer would want what you want them to want, as opposed to stepping outside yourself, taking the time to find out what they actually do want, and then just giving it to them.
You know what? I really wish that there was a device that could automatically take out the extra salt that comes in all the deli meat that I buy, or the hot dogs or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't imagine anybody wanting to have really salty food because I don't happen to like it.
Mm-hmm.
I never have. I just don't like a lot of salt. And so to me, if someone could invent a device that would automatically bring the salt level in my hot dogs down to like 1/4, I'd be very, very happy. And I could get really excited about that idea, like an inventor, and think that who wouldn't want that?
Right.
It could be that there are only 3 other people in the whole world besides me who would be interested.
And in a lot of ways, the smarter you are and the more educated you are, the more you have to be wary of that, because unless you're marketing to an extremely smart and educated niche, really the bulk of the money in marketing is the marketing to the common person. And just like you're saying, the common person these days still is eating a much saltier diet than we really think is good for us or would want to have.
And I have to tell you that I wish I could tell you that was a function of thinking better health. I just don't like salt.
Right. I think this is a mistake that we're all prone to make. It's becoming more dangerous mistake to make because as information technology evolves, people expect the message to market match to be closer.
What does that mean, message to market?
Well, you know, when you're shopping on the internet, the vendors that you're shopping from have the ability to learn about you from the words that you typed in, from your previous shopping behavior. You know, if you click on this product to look at that description, well, they're keeping track to find out what everybody else who did that also bought that day. So consumers are having more and more of the experience of having their individual needs met. And so it becomes even more dangerous to decide that you know what the consumer wants, because technology is evolving to learn about people more and more individually
adapt their needs.
Yeah, and tailor the marketing message directly to their needs. So when we as marketers become self-centered or narcissistic,
think we have a hot idea,
we're in even more danger than we used to be.
Right.
Yeah, so I think that's what gets in the way. I also think that people don't necessarily know how to do good research. They think about throwing up a survey, if they do that. A lot of people don't even think to do that. They think about throwing up a survey, or they think they know how to talk to people, but they're not really aware of all the
nuances
and the biases you can throw in, and how to get to more deeply held thoughts and feelings, and the things that really motivate purchase. I think that there's a real need for a review of this kind.
What kinds of research do you recommend?
I think that when you're stepping back and looking at how you're going to research your market, you have to ask yourself, what can we really be listening for? And I think there's only two things we can be listening for. We can listen for what people do, or look at what they do, or we can listen to what they say. Those are two very, very clear distinctions.
Is one more important than the other?
Well, in the end, I think that most marketers would say that what people do is most important,
right?
Because what you're trying to engender in them is a behavior. You're trying to get them to take out their money and put it on the table.
Right.
But I think that even though people vote with their feet and that's your end goal, the difficulty in just listening to what people do is you don't get a sense of why they're doing it. And if you don't know why people are doing what they do,
how they rationalize it, how it makes sense to themselves.
Yeah, and what was the conversation in their head that preceded them doing what you wanted them to do? So you might get lucky, and you might see that 10% of the market is now buying low-sodium rice dishes, but if you don't know why they're doing that, you don't really have a sense of how to grow that segment. If you could introduce a low-salt rice dish, but you don't know how to maximize that, you don't know how to make sure you converted 9 out of those 10% of people.
Because you want to kind of get into their thinking process and their feeling process that led to the vote that they take.
Exactly.
For example, you made an assumption before that I wanted low salt because I was health concerned.
Right.
And while it's true that I am health concerned, as you know, that isn't the real reason. The real reason is I don't like the way it tastes.
Right.
So you could have the same low-sodium rice dish or low-sodium hot dogs, and the way you would sell it to me versus the way you would sell it to someone who's got high blood pressure is very different.
So even if I followed you around and I saw, hey, this girl buys low-sodium dishes, and I decided to write you a marketing piece all about low-sodium dishes, if I focused on all the health benefits, I'd be missing the mark with you.
Right. I might buy it anyway, but if you told me, well, this tastes a heck of a lot better.
And you might buy it anyway, but the point is that maybe I'm hitting an emerging trend, and so I can get on board with you. But if it is an emerging trend, then other marketers are going to notice that quickly. And the lion's share of those spoils are going to go to the people that really know why.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that you have to listen to both, to what people say and what they do. What they say, I think, is most critically important just before purchase. Well, you talk to me about this all the time, but you see so many even big corporations recruiting interviews and focus groups and survey participants based upon intended future behavior. Like they'll have a questionnaire about, do you plan to buy a car in the next 6 months? What do you think you might buy? Well, the conversation going on in that person's head is dramatically different than the conversation going on in the person's head who's in the showroom looking at cars right this moment.
And even if you ask for people who bought a car in the past year, they don't remember.
Right.
You have to be there in the moment.
Right.
And, you know, we do things in focus groups in the traditional mode, not using all we can do online to do the best we can. But it's true. We're missing that drive and that need and that desire that's right in the moment when they're in the need or whatever it was that made them type in those key words at that moment.
Right, which is why I'm very partial to beginning most research projects online with keyword searches, because you're catching people when they're proactively
searching.
Looking to buy. You are.
Yeah.
You are. And the conversation in their head at that moment is just so key. Just like there's two things that we can listen to, what people say and what they do, I think that there are also two ways to listen. I think you can listen with your heart or you can listen with your head. With your heart is when you are talking to people and trying to make a deep connection with them so you can follow their lines of thinking, and you don't necessarily have a structured questionnaire that you're trying to get them to answer.
What you're trying to do there is to find out what's driving them emotionally. What's the relationship they're looking for? What is this purchase going to mean to them? What does it say about them to have bought that particular kind of thing? What's the end value to them as a human being? What I was thinking about when you were talking is a few months ago I bought a new car, and you suffered through it with me.
I sure did. By the way, Sharon wants a car. There is nothing else on her mind. There is nothing else she can talk about. There's no talking to her about anything else with work or anything like that. It's a traumatic event in her life until she finds the car that she's got to have.
And this particular time, it was very difficult for me because there wasn't one specific one that I really wanted. And we're in the position where I could have had almost anything I wanted, you know, within reason. If you had been following me around and asking me questions about my heart and my thoughts, you, person listening right now, would have been very confused because anybody who knows me would have never have guessed that I would have bought the car that I did, including myself. And I made a head decision that had some emotion to it, but mostly experiential aspects to it. I was deciding between a Mercedes 350R, which looks like a giant hearse, and that's what I bought, versus a Mercedes E, which is sleek and sporty looking and more feminine, and I'm not that big of a woman, you know. And here I am driving around in a Mercedes minivan instead. Most people who know me would have guessed that I would have purchased something that looked more feminine and sleek and pretty and, you know, and it's kind of racy. You can do all that stuff. But I opted for the 350, even though I think it's ugly, because it's functional. It works. And I drive a lot. I have space in there. I have space for the dog to jump into my lap. I have a small dog that likes to drive in my lap. I have plenty of space to cart my stuff around. And as much as it broke my heart to have what I considered kind of an ugly car, although a lot of people would disagree with me about that, I voted with my head and my need for space.
So you're kind of emphasizing the importance of understanding the relationship between emotional purchase motivation and logical purchase motivation, is that what you're saying?
And in the moment, because a week before, had you interviewed me, mm-hmm. you would have probably thought I was going to buy the E.
Sure. Sure.
And, in fact, that's not what I did.
Sure.
So you had to be with me at that moment, the decision moment, to really understand why I did what I did.
Mm-hmm. When I'm thinking about listening with your head, I would be thinking about observing your behavior and trying to abstract it into numbers and run some statistics on it. So I can make estimates about the overall size of the market that was making this kind of a decision.
You'd be asking me specifically, what am I looking for in a car? You know, what are the characteristics and attributes of the car, the make? What does the brand have to do with it in terms of quality, in terms of handling, in terms of size, in terms of comfort?
Right, and I would be quantifying all that and then correlating that to what you actually do.
Right.
On the market level.
Right. So you could be talking to me about it, and you could also be following me around and seeing what I actually did.
I think of listening with your head is kind of like an x-ray of the market.
That's
right?
Cool.
That gives you the structure, shows you where the bones are and how they fit together and where there's a weakness that needs to be supported and where there's a danger spot. And then I think of listening with your heart as kind of like a hug. Really get very close to the consumer and find out how to emotionally connect with them.
As you were talking, I was picturing the structure of the body and I'm picturing, like, you know, gut reactions and heartfelt feelings, which adds dimension and texture that kind of moves those bones.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the meat and the muscle.
What I'm trying to get at here is I think that if you put those two things together, head versus heart, and what people do versus what they say, you wind up with this quadrant.
A matrix.
Yes, but it's just a 2x2 matrix, and there's uh-huh. just four quadrants.
Not the matrix where that guy goes from one world to another.
And they wear those really cool clothes.
And I love that cape.
Right. Not that one.
Okay.
You wind up with a matrix of four quadrants, and I think that every researcher has an inclination to spend all of their time in one of the quadrants. I am particularly good at listening with my head to what people say. I'm particularly good at that. So what I mean by that is I've developed a variety of survey techniques
mm-hmm.
which get an information that most other marketers are not getting at, and then manipulating that information with statistics and drawing inferences about where the real opportunities are, how big they are, what the cost to get into that market space is going to be, and which parts to avoid. I'm really, really good at that. And if I don't watch myself, I would spend all my time in that one quadrant, and I would be missing what you can get by listening with your heart.
What I do mm-hmm. is I look at those segments that you identified, and I pull them into an interview on the telephone or a focus group, and I get them to really tell me their stories and what this means to them and when was the first time they ever had a whatever and what was that like, and I get the emotional connection
mm-hmm.
and how it excites them or serves some emotional need and gives us an opportunity to marry those things together. together.
Mm-hmm. I think that probably everybody's personality will lend itself towards one quadrant. There are some people who like to listen with their heart to what people do, by which I mean getting out in the field and actually living with people
like
in the
Like anthropology,
market.
Right?
Like anthropology. Like before Alex Haley wanted to write Roots, he rented a slave ship and had himself brought from Africa to the United States in similar conditions that the slaves were.
So he could experience it.
So he experienced the whole thing.
That would be doing and listening with your heart.
It would be doing and listening with your heart.
Uh-huh.
So it's kind of like if I were going to do a project on Dungeons and Dragons, probably rather than doing a survey at first, I would just go and spend a week at some of the local gaming houses and see if I could play Dungeons and Dragons. So I think that one of these four quadrants will appeal to people listening, and that's okay. We're going to go through the different ways to specialize in any one of those quadrants. But don't let yourself get stuck in any one quadrant, because I think it's like the joke about the blind man
with the elephant,
and one is holding the leg and they think it's a tree, and another one's holding
the tail and they think it's a snake, right?
Right. And you don't really get the whole perspective unless you tap each of the quadrants. If you want to use the 80-20 rule, if it gets a little bit exhausting, I think that you need to tap two. Like, I know that we've succeeded in many markets because of our combination of skills. Because I love to do surveys and work with all the numbers, and you love to talk to people and listen with your heart to what they say. But we're both listening to what they say kind of people. We're not so much listening to what they do kind of people.
Right.
Between the two of us, I think we get 85% of what we need to get when we're researching a market. When I'm going into a market where the stakes are really, really high and spending a lot of money, if I got a lot of partners and there's a lot of risk, then I'll make sure that I cover everything. If I was going into a silly little niche market, which is kind of a hobby or an experiment, I might just do one. I think that this audio series will be really helpful to people because we're going to talk specifically about each one of those four quadrants and how you can really delve deep in them.
Could you just go over them again so people really understand what the quadrants are?
Sure. There's listening with your head to what people say.
Can you draw a mental picture of the four quadrants?
Mm-hmm.
And what's on top and what goes down to the side?
Okay. So if I had a piece of paper, I make two columns, and I put what they say in the left-hand column and what they do in the right-hand column. And then I'd make two rows, and I would put listening with your heart on the top and listening with your head on the bottom. Okay, so in the upper left quadrant, we have listening to what people say with your heart, and that's Sharon.
That's focus groups,
one-on-one, telephone interviews, having heart-to-heart talks, and
creative sessions.
And there is so much more to that than most people think. I remember I thought that being a therapist just meant being good at talking to people and getting them to come in and open up, and boy, was I wrong. And that's the same thing with research. There's so much more to it than that. So the top left quadrant is Sharon, listening to what they say with your heart.
The bottom left quadrant would be Glenn.
Listening to what they say with your head, which are
essentially
surveys and questionnaires and polls and that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Then there is
what they do with your heart. That would be like my buddy Ava, who goes out and spends hours and hours and hours in people's houses just watching them in their homes to learn about their coffee consumption. But in the meantime, she's learning all about what's important to them in their lives and where coffee fits in.
Yes. Yes, I remember you once did a study where you watch people make tea in
your
house, you took a video camera and you had dinner with them and you watched them make tea, and you uncovered all kinds of problems that you wouldn't really uncover either by doing experiments or by
asking directly.
It was really cool.
That was cool, because what we did originally was we did focus groups, and we had them bring in their tea making supplies and make tea right in the focus groups in person. And we were looking for particular problems that this brand had with their tea bags, and they couldn't figure out what was happening with it, but they knew that they had problems. And what people did in the focus group, the way they made the tea, did not match what they did at home. It was different.
Right.
That was a huge learning.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There's some things you can study in the laboratory and some things you really can't. And there's an effect on the laboratory. Darren, you're...
Now we're going to the bottom right.
But on the bottom right is what they...
Glenn, what they do.
I'm sorry?
It's the head thinking about what they do.
Okay. Listening with your head to what they do.
Right.
And what that means is like rotating different offers and seeing which one they respond to better. It's doing marketing experiments. Online, people are familiar with split testing, where you test one headline versus another. There's some more complicated forms of that. We'll talk about the best of the best there also.
Or like if you were in a supermarket, putting one package in one set of supermarkets and another package in another set of supermarkets, you know, in a match sample,
mm-hmm.
and seeing which sold better.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Or putting them on different shelves.
Very important. Well, that was kind of a long introduction to what we really intended the audio series to be about. In the next section, we're going to talk about what's most intuitive to people, which are focus groups and one-on-ones and actually talking to people in your market and how you can do it and get the most out of it and some of the really serious pitfalls to avoid.
Well, I think that's really exciting because we have learned that a number of people often will just throw up a short survey and they don't really get at the meat.
Yep.
And so I'm excited about that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for your time and attention. If you'd like to find out more about the comprehensive marketing research system I've used to succeed in market after market, please visit howtodoubleyourbusiness.com. That's howtodoubleyourbusiness.com.